Well, may I add my welcome to Margot this Wednesday lunchtime. It's great to see you, particularly a warm welcome to you if you're here for the first time. I'll talk for about 20 minutes or so, and then if you need to get back to the offices, there'll be time to leave then, or we can turn around tables if you've got time to stick around. But please take a look back at that passage from Philippians that we read just now, and look with me please at verse 4. Paul writes, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice." I wonder how you react to that. Maybe it brings a smile to your lips. It's always a good thing, right? Who wouldn't want to rejoice? Well, maybe you think this feels a little bit unrealistic. I mean, joy is okay, but always? Isn't that just slightly impossible? If not, in fact, slightly insensitive to people who are going through a difficult time at the moment. I mean, it's already well to be joyful on holiday or perhaps on a weekend away with friends. But what does this look like amidst the busyness of day-to-day life? Maybe this Sunday you went to church and you left with a sense of joy, a sense of well-being. But Monday morning hit pretty hard, and that sense of well-being felt pretty remote. I think for many people in our society today, that's their view of religion. Religion is a chance for quiet contemplation to help us get through the rest of the week. A moment to step aside, to think on greater truths, maybe to enjoy great music. But it's pretty remote from the day-to-day realities of life. So people will say, well, look, you do religion, that's how you take time out to rebuild. But I do family or sport, or I go to a spa weekend. That's how I build my resilience. But the call here is to rejoice in a way that is embedded in the day-to-day busyness of life. Paul wants our joy to impact our relationships, our anxieties, our thoughts throughout the week. What he's interested in is a faith that changes our lives, because actually, if our faith doesn't impact the nitty-gritty reality of our day-to-day lives, then it is of little value. The context here is that Paul has been writing a letter. He's in prison. He's writing to a church in Philippi, and he's encouraging them to stand firm, to stay united as they face opposition. He's given them some pretty deep theology of the cross, of the hope of heaven, a theology that gives them joy. But now as he moves towards the close of the letter, what he does is show how that joy should enable them to stand firm and stable in their faith amidst the pressures of day-to-day living. Well, there's an awful lot we can say about these verses. Paul says a lot, but I just want to highlight three things. And the first is that Paul talks here of a joy that transforms our relationships. If there's one thing that's guaranteed to destroy joy and peace and well-being, it's a good old-fashioned argument. And that seems to be what's happening here. Look with me please at verse 2. I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yoke fellow, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life. The situation is that there are two women, Euodia and Syntyche, who seem to have had a falling out. And maybe we think that's not terribly unusual. Maybe we've experienced that in our own church. Maybe that's what puts you off coming to church. You think Christians are always bickering. Well, Paul here speaks of a joy that transforms our relationships. Now, we don't know the detail of their falling out. We assume it's not anything of theological importance, or else presumably Paul would deal with that. Maybe it's falling out over the way things should be done. Someone thinks you should have coffee before the service as well as after the service. Maybe a debate about whether or not kids should sing in Sunday school. The issue is not why they've fallen out, it's that they've fallen out. And for Paul, that's inappropriate for the gospel. So how does he deal with it? Well, at one level, he's pretty direct. He names them. I mean, bear in mind that this letter would have been read out in public. You can picture them sitting there, listening to the letter being read out. Perhaps Euodia is just getting a bit sleepy, thinking, wow, Paul, this is a bit of a long one. And then suddenly she hears her name read out. And it's a bit of a shock. She starts slipping down in her chair, desperately trying to avoid eye contact with everyone else. Well, Paul is direct. He wants to deal with this. He's even-handed. He uses the same language. I plead with Euodia, I plead with Syntyche. It's exactly the same words for both of them. And he appeals to both of them to make the first move. So often that's the issue in resolving conflict, isn't it? Someone says, well, look, if he apologises first, well, then I'll talk to him. Or, well, if I thought my apology would be accepted, well, then I would apologise. He wants them to make the first move, and he gets someone to help him. This loyal yoke fellow, we're not entirely sure who that is. It seems to be someone that Paul knows and trusts, who he asked to help with this reconciliation. But, you know, maybe what's more interesting is not what Paul does, but what he doesn't do. He doesn't get into the detail of the conversation. He doesn't suggest a briefing and counter-briefing. He doesn't sort of line up some kind of reconciliation program. What he really does is to appeal to their greater unity. He appeals to them to agree with each other in the Lord, because that's where their unity is, in the Lord. So in the past, they've been contenders together for the gospel. Verse 3, they've contended at my side in the cause of the gospel. And Paul wants them to recover that passion of working together for Jesus' name. One of the illustrations we've used through this series is that of a rowing team, rowing together, contending as they're united, pushing towards, striving towards the finishing line. But it's no point, it's no use if we're all rowing at different times. Well, Paul here is effectively saying, look, it doesn't matter whose speed you're going to row at. You've just got to row together. In the past, they've been contenders together. In the future, well, verse 3, their names are written in the book of life together. That is, they're going to spend heaven together, eternity. So Paul says, well, now agree with each other. That little phrase, to agree with each other, literally means to be like-minded. It's the same phrase that we had back in chapter 2, when Paul encouraged them to have the mind of Christ. You remember how he talks about how Jesus left the glory and the wonder of heaven and came into our world to die on a cross that he might bring his people to his kingdom. Well, that is the mind that Paul wants them to have, to set their hearts on Jesus, to put their hope and their joy in him, to allow Jesus to change their attitudes. Like Jesus, they would lay aside their pride and their arguments and unite together in striving for his message. So this doesn't mean that Paul is wanting them to agree on every single detail, but he wants them to agree in the gospel, in what they believe and how that shapes their lives. What he's saying is that what unites them is greater than what divides them. We might perhaps think of two neighbours, maybe in London, and they're bickering over a fence post and where it should be positioned. And it's the 2nd of September 1939. But of course, just the next day, war will be declared on Germany. And a few months later, they find themselves standing side by side, contending for a greater cause. Well, so it is here. Paul wants these women to see that whatever disagreements they have, they're united together in a greater cause. This is a joy that transforms our relationships, that unites us, even when we're tempted to disagree. So I hope here at the Paddington Talks, we will have that unity. I mean, I guess if we put our minds to it, there are all sorts of things we could choose to disagree over. What flavour of sandwiches to order, how to line up the tables. I guess if you came to our churches, those of us who go to church on a Sunday, maybe our church services would look very different. But our aim here is to contend at each other's side in the cause of the gospel. So we lay aside our differences and we strive together to make Jesus known and to live for him in our offices in the area. It may be that as you're here, you're conscious of a particular issue in your own home church, perhaps your intention with other Christians. Well, Paul would say, "I'm sorted out, be reconciled." And it's important because we live in a society where there are deep divisions and brokenness and selfishness. So often people have nothing better to do than to moan about other people. Whether that's trolls on the internet or people bickering in the office or family disputes. You know, so often when we're on the tube, you'll hear a couple of people, perhaps between Edgware Road and High Street, Kensington, putting the knife into someone from the office. You know, Bob from accounts is getting it. And you just sort of want to lean over and say, actually, maybe Bob from accounts is kind of a nice guy. They've got nothing better to pour their energy into. Well, Paul would say that in Jesus we have deep hope. In him we can know reconciliation to God and therefore to each other. And so we're free to love each other in the way that Jesus has loved us. Even if it's hard work, we need to work it out. He calls us to a joy that transforms our relationships. But you know, for that unity to be vibrant, our faith must be vibrant. So what Paul turns to now is our hearts, our devotion to God. if you go to any of the cathedrals in this country, quite often you'll find a choir singing psalms. It's beautiful, the music, the words. But it's more than just beauty. It's, the psalms really represent the heartbeat of Christian living, of devotion to Jesus. Because they're prayers, prayers of joy, of thanks, of bringing our concerns to God. And that is the theme that Paul turns to now, joy, thanks, and bringing our concerns to God. Because he wants to show us how our love for Jesus will interact with our daily hopes and fears. So secondly, we see here a joy that transforms our fears. Look back with me, please, to verse 4. Paul says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice." It's a surprising verse, isn't it? Surprising because I think often our caricature of a Christian at prayer is of someone who is somber. But here, the picture is a Christian who is joyful. Not only that, but Paul commands it. How can Paul command us to be joyful, even in difficult circumstances? Well, the key phrase is those little words, "in the Lord." That's the key to our joy. Without those words, "in the Lord," this would just be wishful, if not unkind. But the source of our joy is the Lord, and he is unchanging. And if he is unchanging, then our joy in him can be unchanging. It can be always. Even if our circumstances change, how that joy shows itself on any given day. Perhaps we could think of sailing in a boat at night, and we're sailing home, and we see in the distance the harbour light on the rocks of the shore, and we set our eyes on that light and head towards it. And maybe the sea is flat, and maybe the sea is rocky. We may go up and down, we may move around the sea, but our eyes are fixed on that solid joy ahead of us. Well, so it is in the Christian life. We have a fixed joy that we set our eyes on. We long to know God in all his goodness. We see our own brokenness, our rottenness. And we know that Jesus left the comfort of heaven to die on the cross, to pay for our sin, that he could bring us to heaven where we'll know God's love, his goodness, his hope. That is the hope on which we fix our eyes. That is our joy. And that, therefore, is a hope that survives all sorts of circumstances. Remember that the backdrop to this letter is that Paul is in prison and that the Philippians themselves are being opposed. Yet even then, he calls them to joy. So this isn't the sort of fizzy joy of a pop song. It's rather the warm joy of the lights of home. There is Christian joy at a funeral as much as at a wedding. Maybe that reflects you here today. Perhaps you're really struggling with something, you're hurting. Well, Paul would say, don't settle for cheap joy. Don't settle for just singing Christian songs on a Sunday if that joy doesn't then follow through for the rest of the week. Don't settle for the commercial joy of Christmas without the true joy of knowing Jesus. He would say, don't settle for cheap joy. Pursue deep joy. Pursue the deep joy of knowing God in Jesus, of knowing the depths of his love, a joy that transforms our fears. Well, what does that joy look like? Well, at one level, outwardly, it looks like gentleness. Verse 5, let your gentleness be evident to all. I guess most of us want to be known for our humour, our success, our wisdom. But Paul here tells us to be known for our gentleness, our humility, just as Jesus was, leaving heaven. And of course, if our joy is in the Lord, then we'll be free to do that. You know, when you try and get out of a swimming pool, you sort of put your hands on the side and you push down the side as you push yourself up. Well, so often in life, we push other people down in order to push ourselves up. But if our joy is in Jesus, then we'll be set free from that. We won't need to prove anything. Outwardly, we'll be gentle. And inwardly, well, our fears will be calm. Look with me, please, at verse 6. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. I mean, this verse is a little bit like verse 4 on joy, isn't it? It seems a strange thing to command us not to be anxious. I mean, how can Paul command this? Worried about all sorts of things, aren't we? Worried today about finishing a project at work, a deadline, about what our new boss thinks of us. Worried about the future. I know a number of you are on short-term work contracts. What's going to happen next? What about our kids' education? Where are we going to live? What about our parents' health? Anxiety is a huge issue in our society, in our schools and universities. Often it's medical. And even with the choice that we have in society, people are still anxious. Soren Kierkegaard once said, anxiety is the dizziness of freedom, which I think is just a pretentious way of saying that as we have more and more choices in our society, actually we have more and more opportunities to get it wrong, and we're worried about getting it wrong. It's the classic fear of missing out. In all cultures throughout time, people are anxious. And I guess that's why this command not to be anxious is, I think, the most repeated command in the Bible. It comes 300 times. Verse 6, don't be anxious about anything. But how is that even possible? Well, the answer is in the verse. Don't be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. Don't be anxious about anything, by presenting everything to God. When the Church of England appoints a new vicar to a church, there's a moment in the service where the wardens, who presumably have been running around trying to run the church without a vicar for a few months, hand over the keys to that vicar. And as they do so, they hand over all the concerns, all the running of the church, all the worries to him, and he now runs it. But in the same way, Paul is telling us here to hand over our anxieties, to present them to God and to depend on him. And it's that spirit of dependence that lies behind thanksgiving as well. Prayer is when I depend on God by asking how I'm going to cope. Thanksgiving is when I depend on him by giving him thanks for all that he's done for me. And even in the hard times, by recognising that he is the one who knows what is best for me and loves me deeply and more so than anyone else. By the way, it's worth saying, we meet every week at Paddington Talks, just at 8:30 in the morning upstairs in the bar here to pray. If you're able to join us, do join us then. If that's not a good time for you, then let me know if there's another time that works better. I'm very open to moving the time of that prayer meeting. But please, when you pray on a Wednesday morning, remember us in your prayers and please pray for this meeting. Paul's calling us here to a joy that transforms our fears, because it's when we pray, depending on God, that verse 7, the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. The peace, not just an inner sense of peace, but a knowing that we're forgiven before God and therefore that we can be at ease. It's a peace the non-believer cannot explain. But there's a promise here that that peace will guard our hearts and minds. Like the safety bars around a car, we can be secure. It doesn't mean that nothing bad will ever happen to us. I think there may be times when we pray and we're still worried. But there is a sense of hope, of peace. I mean, this is a real hope for us to offer to our world, isn't it? A world that thinks that peace is found in a spa hotel or a weekend break. Here's a peace, not of getting away from it all, but peace right in the thick of it all. A joy that transforms our fears. And then thirdly, a joy that transforms our delights. Look with me, please, at verse 8. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, what is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Now, why is Paul writing this? It's not just because it's a nice thing to stick on a fridge magnet. I think he's doing it because by nature, we do the opposite. We seek what is shameful. They talk these days, don't they, about internet clickbait. There's kind of headlines they put on websites that make you click on them so you can go through and see the underlying story. What is it that people use for clickbait? Well, so often it's scandal or gossip or titillation or intrigue about somebody else. But the gospel would change our mindset. Paul's telling us here to dwell on what is good, what is true, rather than fake news and exaggeration. What's noble, rather than whatever is sordid. Whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, that is what's honourable and good. Whatever is admirable, thinking not of the worst of humanity that I feed my sort of self-righteousness, but the best of humanity that I've been inspired. I wonder if you recognise this character. Yeah, it's one of the Minions, right? We made the mistake at home of allowing our kids to watch the three Minion films on three consecutive Friday nights. And by the last weekend, they just went nuts. They were running around the house pretending to be Minions, you know, sort of breaking things and giggling in a Minion-style way. We become what we watch. Well, whatever we watch on television, what we look at on the internet, what conversations we get involved in the office, the humour that we laugh at, it'll begin to shape us. And what Paul is saying is here is, look, don't shape up, let it shape us. We need to shape it, to shape our delights to have a joy that will transform what we delight in. Now, I think one of the interesting things here in verse 8 is that the words that Paul's using here, pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy, they're not particularly Bible terms. They're not particularly words we've seen in Philippians up till now. They're really words taken from Greek ethics of the day. And I think verses 8 and 9 go together. So you see that repeated whatever. Whatever is true in verse 8 and then verse 9. Whatever you've learnt or received or heard from me or seen in me, put into practice and the God of peace will be with you. That is Paul saying, look, what you've learnt from me and seen in me about the cross and the mindset of the cross, put that into practice. And there's a similar rhythm between the verses. Whatever's true, whatever's noble, whatever's right. Verse 9, what you've learned, what you've received, what you've heard. So I think what he's saying is that we're to see the good in our society and dwell on it, but to dwell on it, verse 9, through the lens of all that Paul has taught us about the cross. So before I had kids, I used to go skiing every now and then. I've got a yellow skiing sunglasses that turn the snow yellow. There's a filter, and it makes it easier to ski. I can see more clearly. Well, so here, Paul is saying, look at the good of society through the lens of the cross, and then you'll see more clearly. So what is it that our society values today? Well, equality, inclusion, diversity, generosity, love, tolerance. And Paul would say, yes, dwell on those things, but through the lens of the cross. So not the tolerance that's intolerant of anyone who believes in an absolute truth, not the love that's about me and how I feel about myself, but the love of Jesus who gave himself for me, the tolerance of Jesus who would die even for me, the inclusion of Jesus who died for all, the diversity, not that's taught in the classroom, but that's seen in a church where people of all ages and classes and races are joined together in the love of Christ. There's a danger of absorbing our culture uncritically. There's also a danger of abandoning it completely. And Paul says here, delight in the good of our culture, but through the lens of the cross. So where have we got to? Well, Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again, rejoice. And for many in our society, that sense of joy or peace, it's just something passing. It's a break from reality. But Paul is calling us here to a joy in the midst of the busyness of life. A joy that transforms our delights, that transforms our fears, and that transforms our relationships. Well, I feel I've said quite a lot. If you need to head back to the offices now, please feel free to do that. Otherwise, there's a few questions on the handout and we can take a chance now just to talk those through.